Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. Toyota on the hot seat.
After 6 miles, God intervened. With the car stopped and both faced on the brake, the motor still revved up and down.
That's Rhonda Smith talking yesterday about her Toyota. Whether or not God intervened, Congress has intervened. Lawmakers want to know what Toyota knew and when they knew it. And yesterday, Toyota started giving answers.
We've done extensive testing on this system, and we've never found a malfunction that's caused unintended acceleration.
Lawmakers have plenty of legislating to do this week, but the real show is in the hearing rooms as Toyota executives go on trial. Today, the big boss is called to the carpet all the way from Japan. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, February 24th. I'm Todd Zwillick in for John Hockenberry for one more day. He comes back tomorrow, and of course, I'm here with Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, Todd. Let's get right to the top stories we're following this morning. More now on Toyota's walk through the Capitol Hill fire pit. Here's Congressman Henry Waxman grilling Toyota's U.S. President James Lentz yesterday.
Do you believe that the recall on the carpet changes and the recall on the sticky pedal will solve the problem of sudden unintended acceleration?
Not totally.
Lentz also apologized repeatedly for the safety problems that led to worldwide recall, saying the company lost sight of the customer.
That sets the stage for Toyota's president, Akio Toyoda, the grandson of the company's founder, to testify before Congress today. We're joined now by Kate Linebaugh, auto reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Kate, good morning.
Good morning.
Well, based on the treatment that James Lentz got yesterday, some of it pretty tough, what kind of treatment for the big boss, I call him, can we expect today in Congress?
Well, I think you'll see Akio Toyoda having the same message as Mr. Lentz, which is accepting full responsibility for the safety woes and talking about what the company is doing, what improvements the company is making. But Akio's challenge is going to be in handling the congressional questioning.
The congressional questioning, and it will be interesting to see how lawmakers question him, because James Lentz said that he didn't know how they were going to handle a lot of the technical issues. That's up to Japan. Kate Linebaugh, stay with us, because we're going to talk to you more about the hearings in just a moment.
Staying on Capitol Hill, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid says he may use a parliamentary shortcut called reconciliation to bypass Republicans and pass a health care bill. Republicans are complaining because the move would allow Democrats to pass the bill with just 51 votes. But Reid says,
realistically, they should stop crying about reconciliation as if it's never been done before. It's done almost every Congress.
Reid says reconciliation has been used 21 times since 1981. In Afghanistan, NATO is putting restrictions on nighttime raids of homes. The directive comes as the coalition looks to reduce tension between its military forces and civilians. And we're also hearing some reports this morning that the next phase of the NATO offensive will focus on the city of Kandahar.
Moving to Haiti now, where at least two American missionaries still held on kidnapping charges are expected to soon be freed. Laura Silsby, the group's detained leader, says the judge told her he won't pursue the case any further.
We are thanking God for the judge's efforts to seek out truth, which will confirm our innocence of all charges.
And at the Olympics, the U.S. took silver in the Nordic combined team relay. American Johnny Spillane says it's been a long road.
It's a great feeling because it's a culmination of a lot of years of hard work and a lot of years of disappointment.
Let's turn to the markets now. Asian markets are down. European indices are mixed and futures are down. The Dow gets underway at 10,292. The S&P opens at 1,094. And the NASDAQ opens at 2213. Coming up later in the show, we talk food every Wednesday. How much do expiration dates really matter? Maybe less than you think. It might just be about the smell test. More on that later.
Our series Frustration Nation continues today as well. Being frustrated is one thing. How about a solution? Some of our listeners have been giving us answers to the gridlock in Washington in just 6 words. Doug in Wyoming says, stop calling Americans stupid and listen. What's your take? 8778-MY-TAKE or post to our site, thetakeaway.org. More on Toyota in a moment.
Yeah.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning. Todd Zwillick here in for John Hockenberry for just one more day. He'll be back tomorrow. Now, Toyota is trying to rehabilitate its image this week, but before it can do that, it has to answer a lot of tough questions about safety and about recalls. And those questions are coming on Capitol Hill in several congressional hearings this week. Today, Toyota's CEO, Akio Toyoda, will come to Capitol Hill to answer questions. Yesterday, it was consumers' chance to speak. After the other, Toyota owners sat down and related startling experiences with their vehicles, like a tearful woman named Rhonda Smith, a driver whose car suddenly accelerated back in 2006.
After 6 miles, God intervened. As the car came very slowly to a stop, I pulled it to the left median. With the car stopped and both feet still on the brake, the motor still revved up and down.
Now that was Rhonda Smith, Toyota owner. Also called to the carpet yesterday was James Lentz. He is president of Toyota North American Sales. Now that's the sales. He's not in charge of manufacturing those cars for the most part. A lot of them are manufactured in the United States, but the decisions are made back in Japan. Kate Linebaugh was at the hearings yesterday. She's an auto reporter for the Wall Street Journal. She was at the hearings yesterday. She'll be at them today. Kate, good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome back to the show. Thanks for joining us. Kate, there were some tears at the hearings yesterday, some tough questions. Were lawmakers as hard on Toyota North America President James Lentz as you thought they would be?
Yeah, I think they were. I think that they asked him some tough questions. I think that there were they were, especially the Democratic lawmakers, were pressing him on whether or not the recalls that Toyota has undertaken will solve the problem of sudden acceleration, to which, as you heard earlier, he said not totally. And this sort of cuts to the heart of what is going on, or the issue that Toyota faces, which is sudden unintended acceleration.
All right, let's hear from James Lentz quick. Let's talk about that, and let's hear what James Lentz had to say about that.
We've done extensive testing on this system, and we've never found a malfunction that's caused unintended acceleration.
He says they've never found a malfunction, but then he was also asked by lawmakers if fixing the floor mats and the pedals will fix the problem, and he said, not totally.
Right, because he says there are many mechanical issues. So sometimes maybe when you turn on your air conditioner, the engine revs. And some people may classify that, according to him, as a surge of the engine or sudden acceleration. He also mentions, and this was sort of the elephant in the room, that he didn't quite come out and say, is that there are human interface issues, which is driver error. This is the issue that both federal safety regulators and Toyota are sort of favor. That is the explanation for a lot of the sudden unintended acceleration that they see. And actually, in the case of the Smiths, NHTSA, in their filing, said that Mrs. Smith had stacked her floor mats, she had put a rubberized floor mat on top of the carpeted floor mat.
Now, NHTSA is the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. Driver error is probably not in public where they want to go right now when these hearings are about Toyota and safety problems and getting to the bottom of it. And later today, we're going to be hearing from the big boss, I'm calling him this morning, from Japan, Akio Toyoda. Kate, quickly, how do you think they're going to treat him?
I think that Akio will be able to speak much more authoritatively for the whole organization. And so many of the questions yesterday, Mr. Lentz was able to say, well, that happens in Japan.
Now, I can't answer that, right?
Right. So I can't answer that. I don't know. Those tests were done in Japan. Well, Akio Toyoda will hopefully be able to bring something to the table from Japan. That said, I mean, I do think there may be some appreciation for the fact that he has made the trip. And the other, you know, potentially this could be in Japanese translation, which would make it a whole lot longer, and that's almost hard to imagine given how long yesterday's hearings were.
Well, for some Japanese translation, we have another guest who can talk to us about Akio Toyoda. Kate Linebaugh from the Wall Street Journal, thanks for joining us. I want to turn now to Bill Emmett. He's a former editor of The Economist, and he spent many years in Japan covering that country. He's joining us now from Italy. Bill, good morning.
Good morning.
Great. Bill, tell us a little bit about the man, Akio Toyoda. He'll be testifying today in front of Congress after a long flight over from Japan. Who is this man?
He is the grandson of the founder of Toyota. It's his name on. That is a return to family control or family leadership of the company after several CEOs who were not from the family. So it's rather like Bill Ford returning family control to Ford. He's an unusual character in that he is quite outspoken. The tradition at Toyota is that they've generally been very shy of publicity. They come from Nagoya, about an hour and a half from Tokyo, not from the capital. They tend to come across as rather provincial, shy people who don't see the point of publicity. He is very outspoken. He told a group of Japanese journalists late last year that Toyota was coming towards a crisis and that it needed big changes if it was to recover. Now, this was before the recall, so I would imagine he now thinks he's really in a crisis.
And Bill Emmett, formerly from The Economist, as lawmakers read his profile and their chiefs of staff brief them about what kind of man this is, do you think after reading those profiles they choose to go at him hard as though he were the CEO of AIG, or do they treat him with deference and respect because he's come all the way from Japan?
Oh, I think they'll go after him fairly hard. Maybe a bit more deferential than with AIG or with someone from Citibank, but they will appreciate that he's come all the way from Japan. However, this is a safety issue. It's a issue of populist politics as well, and they're being lobbied probably by U.S. car makers to treat their major Japanese competitor pretty roughly. And so I think that they will give him a pretty hard time.
Did you think Bill Ford has said he thinks Akio Toyota is taking this recall personally and hard? Do you think that's true?
Yes, I think he probably is. I think he is very outspoken about his company. He's very personal in his defense of it. And he genuinely thinks his company is facing a crisis. But given that they have such a reputation for quality, it really is a serious crisis for Toyota.
Well, congressional hearings like this sometimes can amount effectively to a public trial, albeit a relatively brief one. Akio Toyota called to the carpet in Congress today, and we'll see how he reacts to lawmaker questions. Bill Emmett, former editor of The Economist, who spent many years covering Japan. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Pleasure.
And now at 15 minutes past the hour, let's check in on some stories we're following this morning.
Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid says he may use a shortcut to get the health care bill passed. The fast-track approach, known as reconciliation, would allow Democrats to bypass Republican opposition and pass the bill with just 51 votes. But GOP Senator Mitch McConnell says that's a problem because his party still opposes the bill.
And I would say putting a new name on a whole lot more spending is clearly not reform.
Staying with health care, executives from health insurance giant Anthem Blue Cross have told lawmakers their premium hikes are fair and legal. They say increases will happen. Today, a House committee will question executives from Anthem's parent company, WellPoint, on the planned rate spikes of up to 39%.
A new study says doctors are cutting back on their hours at work. The report says doctors dropped about 4 hours per week from their schedules over the last decade. That's the equivalent of losing 36,000 doctors nationwide. Here's study author Douglas Steger.
Lower fees and increased market pressure on physicians, we think, may have contributed to the decline.
Now to jobs. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office has given an estimate of how many jobs were saved or created by President Obama's stimulus package. It says the stimulus added between 1 and 2 million jobs to the workforce by the end of last year. And finally, after a decades-long ban, the Pentagon may allow women to begin serving on Navy submarines. The subs were off-limits to women because of concerns over how to manage men and women working together in such close quarters.
That's a look at some of the stories you're watching this morning. Coming up to Vancouver, we're going to take a look at the latest from the Winter Olympics.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
And now some takeouts on the stories we're following all week. First up, a monthly poll shows a sharp drop in America's consumer confidence. Louise Story, a finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Louise, what does a sharp drop in consumer confidence mean? Why did it go down so much?
Morning, Todd. You know, one thing that surprises me is that analysts were so wrong. They were expecting it to go down maybe, you know, 1 point. It went down 11 points. And that's because all around us, you know, people are talking about this recovery. But apparently, at least, you know, according to this index from the Conference Board, regular people out there are just not feeling it. And this index focuses on two areas. It asks them how they think about the current environment, what things look like now, and what they expect for the future. And for both pieces, people dropped their expectations, they dropped their assessments, they said, you know, it doesn't look as good as it did the past few months.
So if people are hesitating buying that new refrigerator, buying that new washing machine, that must have implications for the broader recovery.
Absolutely, because, you know, consumer spending is about 70% of the economy. This index also asked people a lot of questions about jobs and whether they think it's easy to get jobs or not, and people said, no, it's still very hard to get jobs, and their assessments of that fell from the last few months, looking like it's a little harder for people to get jobs.
So people are skeptical about money coming in and skeptical about spending it. Louise Story, finance reporter from our partner, The New York Times. Thanks, Louise.
For our next takeout, we'll go to Vancouver for an update on the Winter Olympics. Jason Stallman is the Olympics editor for our partner, The New York Times. Good morning again, Jason.
Good morning.
Unexpected things happened last night. It was the big event. Everyone's been waiting for women's figure skating and some surprises on the ice.
Well, it's going to take a lot for me to kind of rein in the hyperbole here, because what happened in women's figure skating last night was absolutely unbelievable. I was trying to gain a reference point, and I think I had to go back to the Beijing Olympics with Usain Bolt that August night at the Bird's Nest when he ran the 100 meters in a time that completely floored everyone. And a similar thing happened last night at Pacific Coliseum with women's figure skating. The working press, at least, was left staggered, and I think the live audience was as well. Mao Asada, Japanese figure skater who is a gold medal contender, performed flawlessly. She was in first place. The very next skater was Kim Yuna of South Korea, who is widely regarded as the best in the world, and she somehow one-upped her. It was a really spectacular performance that many people who've been around figure skating for a long time said it was the best they'd ever seen, and she set a world record. And then, before anyone could catch their breath, Joanne Richet of Canada stepped onto the ice. This is 2 days after her mother died suddenly of a heart attack, and she had the best performance of her career. And now she's in position for a bronze medal. So a lot to process, needless to say.
The Americans were not expected to show well, but they performed well last night, did they not?
They did perform well. Marina Gasu, the very young American, she went 11th. There were 30 skaters, and she went relatively early. She had a bloody nose halfway through her routine and still finished pretty strong. And she and Rachel Flatt, the 19-year-old high school senior, they're in the running for perhaps a bronze medal. If one of the top three skaters falls or tripped up or otherwise, the Americans could come away with a bronze on Thursday night.
Okay, another big name, Bodie Miller, went to try and get his fourth medal and maybe become the first guy to get a fourth medal in alpine skiing. What happened in the giant slalom?
Well, Bodie started strong, and coming out of the gate, it was quite obvious that he was willing to take every risk he could to come away with another medal. As you mentioned, four in one Winter Olympics would be a record for alpine skiing, and he just got a little bit too audacious on the giant slalom course, and he missed a gate and couldn't regain his line, so he skied off the course. He's got one more chance, that's Saturday in the slalom, to set that record.
We'll be watching to see if he makes it. Jason, stay awake there in Vancouver. Jason Stallman's the Olympics editor for our partner, The New York Times.
Now for our last takeout, we turn the microphone over to you, the listener.
This is Dale Davidson from Manhattan.
She's one of our many listeners who reached out yesterday on our series Frustration Nation. It's about gridlock in D.C., and we asked, is the media to blame, and what's your big media frustration moment?
My media frustration moment came back in the 80s. They decided to change the FCC ownership of radio stations and TV stations so that non-American citizens could own these. And I said, hello, Rupert Murdoch.
Al emails us, Americans fall for spin doctors who use the media to get these voters to react and then blame the media. The Tea Party and healthcare are two prime examples. Voters get spun, and instead of blaming themselves for their own stupidity, they look around for the nearest target, and the media and Congress are to blame.
But out of our responses, Al was actually a minority. Most listeners agreed with Anne from Massachusetts, who wrote on the website, "We depend on the media to call out politicians for misstatements and lies. The healthcare reform issue is an example. We hear most Americans are happy with their health insurance. Then we hear 30 million people are without health insurance. Please clarify what that means."
There are also a few of you who thought like Cedric in Miami and thought the media is not wholly to blame. He posts to our site, "Yesterday, your guest, Kathleen Hall Jamieson from the Annenberg Public Policy Center, said...
Blaming the media for causing the problem is like blaming the family dog or the in-laws for a divorce. Small part of the problem, yes. Central to the problem, no."
That's a weak analogy, Cedric in Miami says. It's more like this. Blaming the media for gridlock is like blaming the vindictive mother-in-law who tries to pass unverified claims as facts and profits from the strife by selling ad space on her blog. Now, of course, we cannot blame her completely, but she didn't help the situation either.
Of course, we're also part of the media here at The Takeaway, and one of the criticisms we've received from Charles on our site, which is thetakeaway.org, "I question the entire premise of this week-long series. Is there gridlock in Washington, or is there a hard and bitter debate about an overwhelmingly huge federal health care spending bill? If your show is trying to leave listeners with the subliminal message that there is no passage of Obamacare, then Washington is guilty of institutional pathology. Charles, well put. We take it. Our series Frustration Nation continues later this morning. Being frustrated is one thing, but how about a solution? We want to hear your solutions at 8778-MY-TAKE. Laura from Miami posts to the site, "Filibustering should just be made illegal." Well, what do you think? 8778-MY-TAKE or thetakeaway.org. Coming up, broadband access is a top priority for President Obama, but even if it reaches the hinterlands, most people there can't afford it. We'll talk about that in just a few minutes.
Good morning, I'm Celeste Headlee. I'm actually joined by Todd Zwillick this week. While he is filling in for John, John is going to be back tomorrow, and you'll head back down to Washington.
Yes,
we're
going to
be talking about broadband internet in just a few moments and why it's important that people have access to it instead of dial-up. But first, let's take a look at the top news stories we're following at 30 minutes after the hour. Toyota President Akio Toyoda will address lawmakers on Capitol Hill later this morning. Toyota is the grandson of the company's founder, and he's expected to apologize for the company's safety lapses and say Toyota might have grown too fast. The company, not the man. Yesterday, the company's U.S. President James Lentz told Congress faulty floor mats and sticky gas pedals are behind the acceleration problems.
"We are confident that no problems exist in our electronic throttle systems in our vehicles."
But Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood says government investigators will continue to focus on those systems.
"We're going to get into the weeds on the electronics."
And that's significant because House investigators say most of the complaints of sudden acceleration came from vehicles that were not subject to the recalls over floor mats or gas pedals. Also on Capitol Hill, the top officials for the Army and Air Force told Congress they'd be reluctant to overturn the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy that bars gays from serving openly in the military.
Moving overseas to Afghanistan, U.S. military officials say they're expanding their network of satellites to increase the coverage and accuracy of GPS devices. That's because the deep valleys of Afghanistan are proving difficult for existing satellites to monitor. Meanwhile, the U.S. military plans to spend more than $600 million to build nearly 200 police stations for Afghan police over the next year. Here at home, major cuts are coming to ABC News. The company says it plans to lay off 25% of its editorial staff. That's about 400 people. And the Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke heads to Capitol Hill today to deliver his twice-yearly economic report. Lawmakers want to hear his plans to ease unemployment and when the Fed will tighten consumer credit. Now let's check in on the markets. Asian markets are down. European indices are mixed, and futures are down this morning. The Dow gets underway at 10,292. The S&P opens at 1,094, and the Nasdaq opens at 2213. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Does this bring back memories for you? Listen to that. That's a great sound. That's the sound of straight out of the 80s. That's the sound of a computer trying to connect to the internet over a telephone line. Well, if you live in a big city, it's probably been a while since you've heard that because you probably use broadband, a cable modem, and you haven't heard that squeak of the 56K modem in quite some time. But in rural America, that's probably a much more recent Memory. Only a third of web surfers have high-speed hookups. 93 million Americans have no access to broadband, and now the FCC is looking to do something about that. We're joined now by Nick Zaberla. He's on the case. He's a community activist in the city of Whitesburg, Kentucky. He started a group called Dial Up Rocks that tries to address this lack of broadband in rural communities. And we're also joined by Brian Stelter, media reporter for our partner, The New York Times. And there's an article in today's paper by Brian on yesterday's FCC announcement and the kind of nuanced stance from the Obama administration on this issue. Good morning to both of you, Brian and Nick.
Good morning.
So, Brian, you wrote about this FCC announcement yesterday, and I was really interested in the categories that the FCC made. The FCC talked about the four categories of people who don't have access to broadband. Can you tell us what those were?
That's right. They saw that some people were very motivated to get online. They found that some people were entirely disinterested in getting online on broadband, and they found that some people just didn't have the tools to do so, and they created clever names for each of those categories. Basically, what they're trying to do is set the table for the rollout of a national broadband plan to get more and more Americans with high-speed internet.
Okay, Nick Zaberla, let me ask you, why does it matter whether somebody has dial-up or broadband? I mean, it's a good thing that most people have access to the internet at all. Does it matter if they can't stream Hulu shows quickly?
Well, I think in rural America, it's not just wanting to download Hulu shows, but it's access to health care, students being able to do their homework, small businesses being entrepreneurial online. We see a lot of people in our community spending a great deal of time trying to get to broadband access, including a young man I have down the road from me who spends about an hour a day traveling to get to broadband access. So I think it's more about quality of life than entertainment.
Brian, the Obama administration is on board with that. They recognize that with our society, the way that our society is today and how necessary it has become to be able to access things over the internet, the Obama administration has made universal access a top priority. But how are they going to do this? How are they going to address the cost issues of setting up the kind of network that will get broadband to everyone?
What they're going to do, and they're going to, they'll be releasing a plan in about a month that will outline a lot of these issues. But so far, what it seems they'll do is try to encourage innovation, try to encourage companies like Google that want to roll out ultra high speed access, and they will try to create a different sort of markets, test markets for this in other ways. But a lot of this is going to be trying to prod the private sector into both speeding up the existing access, the people that already have it, and then trying to reach those last miles, those rural parts of the country that don't have access yet, trying to get that there in the first place. This report found that, about 12% of people that don't have broadband said that's because they couldn't get it at all. And that's going to be the hardest part.
Nick, here's the thing, though. In this FCC announcement yesterday, the thing that is surprising is that 35% of Americans don't use broadband at home, but only 4% of the people who don't have broadband want it or say that they would buy it if they had it, meaning that there are some people out there that are skeptical of the need or the cost is prohibitive of them. So how are you talking to people and actually getting to people to convince them that they need broadband?
Well, we need to think about kind of lifting all communities, and definitely if we think of children who are in those households who want an education future, we really need to think of broadband as a universal service, like we have highways, roads, electricity, and phone service, and that we can't depend on corporations or telecoms because, as here in Kentucky, they will tell you it's cost prohibitive to go that last mile. So I think we really need. I think the FCC is on the right track on providing access that's accessible, and that's including subsidies for hardware, for equipment, for people to get online.
Well, that's my next question for you, Nick. You anticipated it. What happens if that last mile is covered, and then it's just that much more expensive for people? Are you confident that subsidies will be sufficient, that it'll be worth it for people to buy it, or will it just be too expensive?
I mean, I think this is it's an investment that we need to make. If you in a rural town, it really is going to come down to the economics, where you have folks who are choosing between paying for their electric bill or
buying prescription medicine, we have an opportunity in this country to really raise all ships. Is that last mile going to be affordable for everyone? No. But is it something that we need to do as a society? Definitely. We have communities here where the telecom has run the broadband access within 100 yards of people's homes, but are not willing to stretch it those final feet for cost prohibition.
And Brian Stelter, did the FCC say anything about what they call the digitally distant? These are people who are around 63 years old, 10% of the population, who say they don't see what the relevance of the internet is?
This is the part that fascinates me personally. I think what the FCC has said is that if once you're online, you understand why it's important to be online. The problem is getting those people to try it in the first place, to come online and realize it's not simply a place to get viruses and to get scammed. Certainly it's possible. Certainly you need to have some sort of education.
Try it, you'll like it, right?
Having that education is going to be an important part. But once you're online, you realize those dangers are minimal.
Yeah.
And really that's what sells you on it.
Brian Stelter is the media reporter for the New York Times. Nick Zabarla is a community activist. He runs the group Dial Up Rocks, an advocacy group in Kentucky. Thanks so much.
My chickens ain't got no scratch. My internet connection has been blown all out of whack. I need a universal broadband.
Good morning, it's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. Now to our international business segment. A court in Italy has convicted three executives from Google for allowing an abusive video to be shown on YouTube. Now, Google owns YouTube. They acquired it about a year and a half ago. And the video shows a teenager with Down syndrome being bullied at a school. The three executives had no involvement in the video itself, but they were given six-month prison sentences by the court in absentia. They weren't there for defamation and violation of privacy. Again, they had nothing to do with the video in the first place. Now, Google has said the trial is a threat to freedom of speech and that it shouldn't be held responsible for all of the content of the items on its website. Well, the BBC correspondent Duncan Kennedy has been following the trial in Rome, and he joins us now. Duncan, good morning.
Good morning, Todd.
As we said, the video shows some teenagers harassing another teenager who had Down syndrome and that it was posted in 2006. Now, that being the case, why were Google executives held responsible?
Well, the courts and a pressure group, a campaign group for Down syndrome, decided that Google hadn't acted fast enough in taking it off its site. It was actually up there for about 2 months before Google says it was alerted to this video being on its site, and it took it down as soon as possible. Google said it cooperated with the police in identifying the four teenagers who were doing the bullying. They were suspended from school. The person who posted the video has since been prosecuted here in Italy. So Google's position was that it did everything it could as soon as it found out. But the court in Milan has decided that that's not good enough, and what it's effectively saying is that Google was responsible for the video being posted in the first place. Now, Google's defense all along is that it cannot police all these videos on YouTube, on Google Video. There are tens of thousands of them across all time zones right around the world. It can only do things once they're up. It can take them down as quickly as possible, but it cannot police them beforehand. But the courts in Milan decided that wasn't the case. They are responsible, and they have been convicted.
Now, I just said that Google acquired YouTube about a year and a half ago. That wasn't right. It was back in 2006, just after the video was posted. I want to point that out. Duncan Kennedy from the BBC, Google executives must feel that this is like a case, if I owned a building and somebody came and wrote hate speech on the wall, I could be held responsible for not erasing it fast enough.
Exactly right. That's the perfect analogy. One other Google executive put it this way. They said, it's like the post office, the postal service, trying to stop hate mail being sent through the post. Now, in the United States, where I am in Italy, tens of millions of items go through the post. How can you stop the one or two hate mail letters that go through?
So
that is their position.
What are these executives saying, then, is the implication for other internet platforms across the internet?
To quote Google, they've just put out a statement, their reaction to this case. They're extremely angry. They're saying they're deeply troubled by this conviction, especially on the point about who is responsible for posting the content. They say that if it falls to the content providers, the Googles, the YouTubes of this world, then in Google's words, the web as we know it will cease to exist.
Well, are these
Google
three...
say... Sorry?
Please go ahead. I'm sorry. I interrupted
you. Google are saying it's the responsibility of the individual who makes the video and posts it. That is where the responsibility should lie, not with the platform on which it is posted. They say they act as a responsible corporate entity by taking it down as soon as they are made aware of it. But they said in the first place, we cannot stop tens of thousands of videos being posted all day, every day, right around the world. It's simply not realistic.
And that could have huge implications across the internet. Duncan Kennedy, Rome correspondent for the BBC. Google executives found guilty for content posted on YouTube.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. I'm Todd Zwillikin for John Hockenberry. Just for one more day, I'm here with Celeste Headlee, of course. Coming up, we talk food like we do every Wednesday. Now, how unsafe, by the way, are expired foods? We talk with someone who ate only expired food for 2 whole weeks, and she joins us with her stomach's story in just a few minutes. Right now, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes past the hour. During hearings on Capitol Hill, Toyota's top U.S. executive, James Lentz, told lawmakers he isn't sure if the company has the right solution for sticky accelerator pedals. He also said Toyota dropped the ball when it came to managing the problem.
It's taken us too long to come to grips with a rare but serious set of safety issues, despite all of our good faith efforts.
Lentz insisted that sticky pedals are not caused by electronic issues in the vehicles, but Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood says his department will investigate those claims. Moving overseas now, a big story out of Turkey this morning. A court in Turkey has charged 7 senior military officers with plotting to overthrow the government. To explain more on this, we're joined by the BBC's diplomatic correspondent, Jonathan Marcus from London. Jonathan, good morning.
Yes, good morning, Todd.
Or good afternoon to you.
not quite.
Not quite. You're getting there. Jonathan, what are these 7 senior military officials accused of having done?
Well, they are just a few, a handful of a much larger number of military figures who it is alleged have been engaged in efforts to mount some kind of military coup in Turkey. This is essentially, if you like, a kind of constitutional struggle which goes to the rather peculiar role of the military in Turkey, which sees itself as the bastion, the defender of Turkey's secular revolution. And of course, now with a mildly Islamist political party in power, the AKP. So it's very much a political a battle of wills.
And do we have a sense that these particular 7 officers were in the sights of the government for political reasons, or is there reason to believe they may have been plotters?
I think it's more that, I mean, we don't know what they were doing, but it's more a case of the military and this Islamist party being, if you like, at loggerheads. I think it's interesting, though, because we use this label Islamist. If you go to the AKP's headquarters, like I've been to in Ankara, you find men in sharp suits all packing BlackBerries. It looks just like any other modern political party in Western Europe. So, you know, this is a very interesting and intriguing Turkish political battle, but clearly one that threatens to overturn the calm of Turkish politics that has reigned for some years now.
Long history of tension and balance between the elected government and the military in Turkey. Jonathan Marcus from our partner, the BBC. Thank you.
Back at home, let's bring you the latest on the health of the former Vice President, Dick Cheney. Doctors say he did have a mild heart attack on Monday, but is feeling better today. He's expected to leave a Washington hospital in the next few days. And finally, at the Winter Games yesterday, the U.S. took another medal. This time it was the silver in the Nordic Combined Team Relay. That's a ski jump followed by a cross-country race. That win helps keep the U.S. in the lead at the Olympics with 26 medals so far. Those are some of the news stories we're following this morning.
Hey, that's the Fat Boys, and the Fat Boys means Wednesday, which means the food on the takeaway. Now, as more people are being forced to stretch their food dollar, a question does come to mind. Can I eat that expired soup lingering in the back of the fridge? What about that apple? It's a little soft, but is it okay? Or will I get sick if I eat it? Well, Nadia Arumugam is a food writer whose work has appeared in Slate and The Guardian and The Times of London. And that's not all. She also embarked on a project. Her diet consisted solely of expired food for a whole 2 weeks. Apparently she survived because she's sitting across from me and she's here to tell us what she ate, what she learned, and how her stomach felt along the way. And I'm also going to ask her how it tasted. And for the science behind the experiment and the science of, frankly, older food. Dr. Ten Labuza is here. He's a food scientist at the University of Minnesota, and he's worked with the Department of Defense on food safety issues. Nadia, I want to start with you. You ate expired food for 2 weeks. Now, you look okay to me. You look healthy. You're not green, at least. Does this mean that expired food, by definition, is safe, or is there a division here? Some is safe, some isn't.
Well, you know, this might be a surprise to you, but expiration dates address the quality and freshness of your food, not safety. So when you eat cookies that have sat around for maybe 6 months too long, they might not be too tasty, but they're not going to make you sick. So in fact, there are no federal regulations that govern expiration dates, apart from infant food and baby formula. Now, you do have a few states that have rules when it comes to dairy products. But mostly, almost everything else that you see in the supermarket that has a printed date on it, those are decided purely by manufacturers. So in my experiment, that I decided that I wanted to just see how far my human instincts, my basic common sense, was going to take me. Now, let's not forget that food is an organic substance, and nature is going to tell us when it's not right to eat. So, for example, let's say you have a head of broccoli in your fridge. The florets are yellowing, they're getting all mushy, it's feeling very light and wrinkly. That's basically nature's warning signals to you, saying that you need to throw it out. The nutrients are depleting, it's not going to give you any value. On the other hand, let's say you have some prepared broccoli in a pack. Now, if that's a day or two past its use-by date, but it still looks very green, very fresh, the stalks are firm, the florets are tight, again, that's nature telling you that it's perfectly fine for you to cook it up and enjoy it.
So really, it might be more about the sight test and what we've always called the smell test. The smell test is a cliche. Rely on that, you're saying, mm-hmm. rather than just what's printed on the label. Well, I want to turn this around on Dr. Labuza, because you're on the scientific end of this. Dr. Labuza, I understand you've tried 7-year-old chicken, and this was in a bunker in Washington?
Right. Well, it wasn't in Washington, and it was 7-year-old, but it was a canned chicken.
Ah, okay. And, but 7 years old nonetheless.
Right.
And you've lived to tell the tale.
Yeah, and it was stored at refrigerated temperature, and so that, it tasted just as good as the freshly canned product.
Now, on the other side of this, Dr. Labuza, there are foods that we've been told never go bad, and I want to run a couple of these by you because it may not be the case with some of them. What about salt? Can salt go bad?
Well, salt, the typical table salt that you use is probably millions of years old, and it doesn't go bad unless it's high humidity. At high humidity, above 75%, then the salt will start to cake up. Okay. You'll see a wet surface on it, and it gets stuck together. And people put rice in their salt shaker, and that usually takes care of the problem.
Good point. It's in the ground for millions of years before it gets in a cylindrical shaker, I guess. Now, what about vinegar?
Vinegar has some eggs in it of what we call vinegar eels. They're little organisms, and so after a long time, you can start getting eels in it.
I'm sorry.
They're not going to make you ill.
I'm sorry. You just said eels?
That's what we call them, but they're little worms.
Little worms in the vinegar.
Right.
So you got to watch out for worms if your vinegar is old. That's counterintuitive because vinegar is supposed to be sort of a classical a preservative. Now, finally, what about honey?
Honey can ferment. Yeast can get into it and cause fermentation. The Romans and the Greeks used to, in fact, allow that to happen to create an alcoholic beverage called mead.
Mead, right, like from back in when I used to read Beowulf in high school. Well, Nadia, let me ask you. You seem to be suggesting, by saying that expiration dates are put on there by the manufacturer, that this is sort of like my toothbrush, when they put a blue strip on there and they say, oh, the blue strip is worn out, get a new toothbrush. Mm-hmm. Toothbrush is perfectly fine. It still works. I use it for, I dare say, 3 years after the blue strip is worn off. Is this basically the same thing on canned food or packaged food?
Yes, you know, I'm essentially saying use the expiration dates as a guide if you like, but ultimately don't rely on them.
Use your nose.
Use what survival skills nature has given us.
Right. We've been dealing with old food since the dawn of time, I suppose. Well, speaking of old food, you've got some with you there, so why don't you go ahead and pass it out? Now, what have you got?
I basically dug around in my fridge last night in my cupboards.
Okay.
And, you know, I have this jar of mayonnaise that I have.
All right. I'm reluctant. Old mayonnaise makes me. All right.
I had this in a sandwich 2 days ago, and I looked at it last night, and I realized that the best of use by date. May 2009, and okay. I hadn't noticed a single thing. It tasted perfectly
well.
To
you
me.
Know, toss that mayonnaise
okay,
over here,
you
or you can hand it across. Now, you're talking to someone, Nadia Celeste. I'm a guy, if I seem, first of all, I don't love mayonnaise. I'm taking one for the team here at the Takeaway because I don't love mayonnaise in the first place.
Just stick your finger in it.
But if I, well, it's hey, it's from Mayo 9. Why not? Although you're probably keeping it. You know, if I...
No one's allowed to stick their fingers in my face.
I feel like I'm taking a risk. Okay, well, it tastes fine. Nadia, you know what? The takeaway for me is Mayo 9 for mayonnaise. You've won me over. I suppose it's okay. Thanks for coming in and educating us about old food. Nadia Arumugam is a food writer whose work has appeared in The Slate and Guardian. She had expired food for 2 weeks. And of course, Dr. Ted Labuza from the Department of Defense has worked at the Department of Defense and the University of Minnesota. Thank you both.
We have guidelines on our website on what is okay expired food to eat. You can take a look at that at thetakeaway.org. Also, anything else that's going on the website, our newsletter, you can also respond to anything that you've heard, including our series, Frustration Nation, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or our site, thetakeaway.org. I'm Celeste Headley.
I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry. I might keep this mayonnaise. It's actually not bad. Can I keep this? It's The Takeaway.
Go for it. It's my community.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway Podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.